acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 50, Podiversary. Sunday, August 17th, 2014. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Yinhu Chaoyuan, Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode can be found on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. Today's episode includes the following segments: Gratitude Journal, The Front Porch, Ever-Expanding Skill Set, and Double Happiness. It's been a great week here at Yinhu. The weather has been cool and breezy and sunny. We did have a little much-needed rain. And then on Friday, I woke up and it was cool in the morning, as it has been. I went for a walk, and when I got back from my walk, it felt cool enough to put on a sweatshirt. And the temperature kept dropping, and by noon, I started a fire in the fireplace. And then by evening, all I wanted to do was order takeout and curl up on the couch in front of the fire and watch some episodes of Tales from the Green Valley. This is a BBC Two series, a documentary series that I heard about from Amy Beth of the Fat Squirrel podcast. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and folks are frequently making recommendations of this show and that movie and this book and this article and things like that. And often something will appeal to me and I will check it out. I was very curious about this show based on the things Amy Beth said about it. So I investigated and I watched the first episode. It was so good. I couldn't believe how drawn in I was to the whole premise of the show. And what I really wanted to do was just keep watching all of the episodes. But I knew that Samuel would also be interested in it. And so I held back. I only watched the one episode. And then when we were hanging out in front of the fireplace on Friday, I said, "Hey, you know, I heard about this show and I watched the first episode. Think you want to try it out?" You know, I explained what it was, and he said, "Oh, yeah." Well, we watched the first six episodes. We watched 3 hours of Tales from the Green Valley. This is a 2006 documentary series on the BBC, BBC Two. It features life in the 17th century, the early to mid 1600s on a farm along the border between England and Wales. The farm has been restored. It fell out of use in the late 1800s, and it's been restored, but it's still in the process of restoration, or it was in 2006 when this series was filmed. And the series follows five academics over the course of 1 year. So each of the episodes is a month of the calendar year, and the academic folks are specialists in customs and clothing of the time, farming practices. Two of them are more into sort of social and cultural norms, and the three younger participants are all archaeologists. So they have a lot of learning and a lot of research and practical experience on digs, but they have never lived as though it were the 1600s and they were only using the materials and tools that would have been available to a farm family of that period and in that region. It's fascinating. I watch it and I feel like I'm learning so much, but I also feel like I have about 100 more questions every episode. If you're into history or you're curious about what farming life would have been like, I just can't imagine who would not be interested in this amazing undertaking. So if you haven't been able to tell, I'm very enthusiastic about this program, Tales from the Green Valley. I'm watching the episodes on YouTube. They're 30 minutes long and there are minimal advertisement breaks. So I hope you check it out and enjoy. On Saturday, I had a day of animal encounters near the Delaware River. The first encounter occurred on my morning walk. I've been walking around Shawnee Village area and some of the trails along the Delaware River with my neighbor, and we were walking along and talking, and all of a sudden I stopped in my tracks because above the trail in some pretty steep terrain, an adult black bear was just standing there looking at us and must have been standing there for some time because I think I would have detected it if it had been moving. But standing still, it just looked like a shadow until I was right nearly on top of it. And we walked back there today to figure out what the distance would have been. I think it was under 30 feet. Not on the same level, so it was up above us. But I happened to have my phone in my pocket, so it was kind of like a staring standoff, and I managed to slip my phone out of my pocket and take a quick photograph. Maybe it wasn't the best idea. I don't know. But we didn't feel threatened. And later on, my neighbor was joking. She said, I should have gotten in the picture for scale. And I'm like, oh yeah, because that's what really we were thinking when we were had our knees knocking together because there was a bear right there. It was scary and exciting at the same time. I've seen bears quite frequently around this area, but I've never been that close to one, and I've never come upon one without realizing it was there. I think that was the difference in this particular encounter. So not wanting to go back exactly how we had come, we took this very long detour back around through the woods to complete our walk. When I got home, the baby wrens who have taken up in a birdhouse on our property right near our porch were leaving the nest. So Samuel and I got to watch as the last two were coaxed out of the nest by their parents and took some really awkward, dismal flights. One landed on the porch a couple of times before it finally got the hang of things. And then they all took off and they were all gone. So within 20 minutes, you know, we didn't see any birds. We didn't hear them anymore. They just said, see ya, bye-bye. I don't think it's early enough in the season for that pair to nest again. I know that wrens will nest quite a few times in a season, but I think this is probably the last time for that pair. Maybe they'll be back, though. This is a new birdhouse, and they discovered it very quickly after we put it up, and hopefully they'll be back. Later in the afternoon, Samuel and I attended a wedding at Shawnee Inn along the Delaware, and it was held right along the banks of the river in a pavilion. Toward nightfall, maybe about 7 o'clock or so, the sky started to darken, and we noticed that a few people were interested in a bird, a large bird that had perched in a tree overlooking the water. So Samuel turned to me and he said, well, what do you think that is? And I don't know where I got this notion, but I said, it's a cormorant. It was a large bird that had a heron or egret-like appearance, and it was very black. I guess, I don't know where I got this knowledge that it was a cormorant, but when I got home, I looked it up, and I thought these birds were found only along the coastline, or maybe in salty marshes. But according to our bird guide, it seems like they are often found further inland and that populations are increasing. But I feel very fortunate to have seen one. It sat preening on that branch for more than a half hour, and a lot of people were able to get a good look at it. I did take a substandard photograph of it, but you can see clearly the outline against the sky, and I added it to the show notes on the website so you can take a look. That concluded my day of encounters with wildlife along the Delaware River. It was a very gratifying day and an excellent way to celebrate my podiversary. I can hardly believe that a year ago, I was holding my head in my hands, close to tears, because I couldn't figure out how to use WordPress, and I had decided to start this podcast and recorded my first episode, and everything was going wrong, and who did I think I was, and how was I going to have time to have a podcast with all the other things that I'm busy doing? And I was just kind of overwhelmed by anxiety and fear. But thanks to the support of my family and a number of my colleagues, and then the enthusiasm of listeners, I've managed to carry through a full year of podcasting. It's been an incredibly rewarding experience, and it has changed my thinking in a number of ways. I thought I would just talk a little bit about, you know, the narrative of the year, a little bit about my goals and objectives and things that I've learned, and then answer a few listener questions, and maybe review a couple of things that I've talked about in previous episodes, but new listeners might not realize that information or might not have heard about it. I guess my inspiration to begin a podcast is due to the overwhelming influence that podcasters have had on me and my learning and my crafting. My first introduction to podcasts had nothing to do with knitting or crafting podcasts. It was food podcasts that really interested me, and I still listen to a number of them and learn a great deal. Then I turned to introducing podcasts into my classroom. As an English teacher, I felt like it was a great way for students to consolidate some of their learning and to find a real and authentic audience for what they wrote, and to write for true diversity of audiences and purposes. One problem in education is that everyone knows that you're writing for the teacher and the teacher is going to score the work. So it's very difficult to step out of the charade that's going on in the classroom when you're trying to get students to write for this purpose or write this task. When you publish a podcast and it really goes out over to the airwaves and people really listen to it or comment and respond, students have an authentic experience with writing and reaching an audience. So I started doing that with my students. And in order to demonstrate podcasting and what it was all about, I recorded a few podcasts. And they were mostly about, you know, like an introduction to the class or a podcast for their parents. You know, here's what to expect from AP literature, etc. And I had thought at times about having my own podcast with an adult audience, maybe doing exploring some kind of literary themes or exploring something with food. But then I started listening to podcasts and watching podcasts that had to do with knitting and spinning and weaving, the fiber arts. And then I became convinced that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to incorporate different elements of my life and my knowledge and share it with others. So I came up with the structure and the name Yarns at Yin Hu based on the home where I live and that I've been restoring with my partner Samuel. It's a replica of a Chinese tea pavilion, a rustic replica of a Chinese tea pavilion. It's located near the Delaware Water Gap in eastern Pennsylvania, right along the border with New Jersey. And it's become a place of nurturing and inspiration for me, and I thought that would be a suitable name for a podcast. Samuel helped design a logo, and I researched different methods of putting a podcast online. I had a lot of equipment because I had purchased quite a few things when I was doing podcasts with my students. And I recorded my first episode, started a Ravelry group, and just kind of waited to see if anyone would listen to it or know about it. I imagined talking to my mom when I recorded, because talking to mom, she's always a receptive audience for whatever it is I have to say. So I imagined her as I was recording, and gradually I gained confidence and I started to think differently. So there's this saying in writing, when a writer writes every day, he enters this state of continuous composition, and he doesn't really need to be sitting at the writing desk in order to be in the act of composing. He's composing all the time, and then he's just getting it down on the page when he actually sits to the writing desk. And to me, that's what's happened a little bit with crafting and cooking and other areas of my life in having a podcast. I'm thinking about it all of the time. So I feel like I'm podcasting all of the time, not just when I sit down to record. And that's been interesting to process the knitting and the weaving and the different ingredients I'm experimenting with in my kitchen. I'm always thinking about it through the lens of having an audience and talking about it on a podcast later on. Being the geek that I am, when I began the podcast, I had a special notebook and I recorded all of my show notes in the notebook. And today I was just looking at some notes I made last August when I started, and I wrote goals. By August 16th, 2014, I will have recorded 45 episodes, have a 500 member audience, have 25 reviews on iTunes, and have Ravelry posts 2,000 or more. So I thought I would tally up the actual results, and this is the 50th episode. I knew that I didn't want to hit a target of recording every week because I just knew that wouldn't be possible. I didn't really think I would get over the 45 episodes, so I'm pretty excited that I was able to exceed that. In terms of a 500 member audience, I had listed Ravelry and Facebook as how I would count my audience. And since then, of course, I've added Twitter and I've also added Instagram, and the audience is nearing 1,000 if I think about, you know, the number of people who have joined the group on Ravelry and the number of followers I have on Instagram, etc. I know that some of those are not unique audience members because, you know, they're doubling up and might be a fan of the show in a couple of different ways. But that's twice the number that I was anticipating having. So that's incredibly gratifying. On reviews on iTunes, there are currently 26. Since I last recorded, there were two more reviews written on iTunes. So thank you for those reviews. Blue Jeep and TK Busy, who I know is Mary Beth, and then an anonymous reviewer who left a 5-star review. So thank you so much for that. And in terms of Ravelry posts, it's over 1,000. I didn't count up the number of Ravelry posts. I think discussion on Ravelry has been more challenging than some of the other aspects of having a podcast. And certainly in recent months, when the Ravelry group has grown, the conversation has become more frequent on Ravelry. And I try to engage with listeners as much as possible. And I'm so grateful for the truly interesting posts and photographs that listeners put up on the Ravelry board, particularly with the Bulk Bins cook-along. And that has been a more recent development starting in the new year. I wanted to set up a project for myself that could become a part of the podcast, but that would be real and meaningful, something useful and practical. And so I decided on this Bulk Bins cook-along, where each month of the year I would be experimenting with a different ingredient from the Bulk Bins at my local health food store. And then I would develop at least one recipe each month of my own and photograph it and post it on the website. And then I would try other recipes that I found online or just relying on my instincts and experimenting with the ingredient. And that I would include listener participation and ask folks to cook along and share their experience and share recipes. And that has been an incredibly gratifying aspect of the podcast. I love the conversation. I feel like I'm cooking more. I feel like I'm trying new things more frequently instead of just relying on the same old, reliable recipes that I could make in my sleep, and really experimenting with ingredients and thinking about their nutritional content as well, thinking about how sustainable those ingredients are and what's going on with the environment. And that has been a lot of fun. Earlier today, I mentioned that I would be recording later and asked if anyone had a question that I should answer on the podcast. And I received a lot of well wishes and not too many questions, but thank you so much, Veronica VB Doherty, who wanted to know what vitamins I take. But I think that was tongue in cheek. She was wondering how I get so much done. Linda Thompson 23 asked, I missed earlier episodes, so don't know why your house has such an interesting name and what you do for a living. So, Linda, I talked a little bit about that just a moment ago. Yin Hu Cha Yuan translates Silver Lake Tea House. This home used to sit on a lake because the creek running by was dammed and the water pooled up. And there were pleasure boats on that water. The dam broke in the flood of 55. And since then, it's been more of a creek, although when we have extreme heavy rainfall, and we have had flooding in this area several times since I've moved here, that area that used to be a lake fills back up again. It definitely flows over to the other side of the creek, so our house is in no danger of being flooded unless something incredibly extreme happened. But it pools up there. And so the river bottom on the other side of the creek is somewhat soft and marshy all of the time. It's a great place for wildlife. And originally this house was not a home. It was a business. It was actually a functioning tea room. It served luncheons and suppers. And the upstairs was accessible only from the outside and was a gift shop. And it was filled with products brought over from China that would have been very unusual and interesting at the time. Samuel and I are the first people to own the home and property and live in it. Previous owners did not live here. And it was restored very shoddily from a more commercial space into a home in the 70s. It was done cheaply with unskilled craftsmanship. And as we renovate and restore, we're having to undo a lot of substandard workmanship. We have a lot of the restoration complete. And if you own an older home, you know that you're never, ever, ever done. But we feel like we've made some good strides, and we try not to always be working on a new project, one, because funds don't allow, and two, because it's extremely small. This home is about 850 square feet, maybe less. It does have a porch that wraps all the way around, so during warmer months, we live outside on the porch. But it means that any kind of construction or undertaking like that, it takes over our whole lives. It's not like we're just working on one part of the house and we're living in another. We're living in the mess and the dust and the tools and stuff nonstop. So we try to undertake a project and go at it full throttle, and then bring it to completion as soon as we can, and then take a break and not work on anything and, you know, let our bank account recover and then tackle something else. Right now, the two main projects are the kitchen and the bath, and some pretty extensive overhaul of the, water and plumbing in order to make that happen. So those things are probably quite far into the future. We think about them and dream about them, and someday they will be accomplished. Linda also asked what I do for a living. I'm an educator. For a very long time, I was an English teacher with an English classroom, and 4 years ago, I made a transition into coordinating a gifted and talented program for two high school districts in Morris County, New Jersey. It's a job I very much enjoy, and part of my interest in the crafting and the fiber arts and a gradual shift in my way of thinking has come about as a result of changes to my job description. I think differently now, coordinating a gifted and talented program than I did when I was responsible for an English classroom. And it's interesting how the patterns of our lives change gradually, and changes in one area influence change in another. Wisdom Wellness, Christy, asked about her cupcake. The episode photograph is one of a crocheted cupcake that I made for Christy. It's been a couple of years, and I filled it with lavender. I wonder if she still has that, but I took a photograph of it and I thought it was a good photo for today's episode. She wanted to know what I wanted to be when I grew up as a young girl. I didn't think a lot as a child about careers. Mostly I was encouraged to be focused and be goal-oriented, and you never, ever, ever wanted to be idle in front of my parents because they would find a job for you to do and guaranteed it would not be a job you wanted. So I think just learning industry was an important part of my upbringing. Pretty early on, I expressed interest and ability in writing, and certainly reading was a great passion. And becoming an English teacher was a very natural fit. Before I graduated high school, I had notions of training as a chef and going to culinary school. And I was dissuaded from doing that, I guess because I was a high achiever in school, and so I was steered towards something more academic. I do think I would have enjoyed a more practical vocation, something more hands-on, and maybe my current interest in food and cooking and crafting is a way to fulfill those interests. In terms of keeping a gratitude journal for this podcast, I just have overwhelming thanks to express to Samuel for help with all of the digital components of making a podcast, for friends and colleagues who have not only encouraged me but actually listen to the show. Some of them confess to fast-forwarding through the knitting parts, which I think is funny. I'm thankful to my fellow podcasters and the many mentions of Yarns at Yinhu from podcasters I admire. Getting their recommendation and meeting them in person has been a very exciting aspect of this past year. And to friends that I've made, listeners who have stated that they enjoy the podcast, they've given feedback, they're participating in the Asymmetrical. There's no greater reward than to know something you're putting out there each week is really meeting the desires and demands of an audience. So it's my pleasure and my privilege to continue working on this podcast and to give it a go for another year. I think in a few ways, I'll probably scale back a little bit. I would like to put out fewer episodes and spend a little more time cultivating a little more depth and dimension, particularly in the area of interviews and research. And in order to do that, I need a little bit more time between episodes. So currently, I've been thinking about 3 per month or 36 episodes. I have never tried to record on a particular day of the week and put the podcast out on a particular day. So I will continue with that lack of commitment because I think most of the time I would just be apologizing for not putting it out on that day, and that's just not the way I want to proceed. So I think it works well when several times a month I put out a podcast, and then other times, you know, I'm thinking and developing and working on my knitting and things like that. So I'm very interested in another year in growing listenership and in meeting people who listen to the show. I hope to visit a number of fiber-related events, maybe visit yarn stores that are new to me, take some classes, continue with my own learning and my own understanding. Being relatively new to the fiber arts world, I feel like I have a lot to learn, and I'm very grateful to all of the folks who have been my teachers, whether formally or informally. So thanks for listening to Gratitude Journal, and I look forward to another year podcasting Yarns at Yinhu. The Front Porch. On the front porch is continued Christmas knitting, and part of that will be felting. I have undertaken a number of felting projects. I'm using Patton's Roving and Debbie Stoller Full of Sheep, which felts incredibly well. Both of those yarns felt very well. The felted projects are for the men in my family, and they are of two varieties. I will be making some pot holders, and I'm using scrappy felted oven mitts by Kelly Schroeder as my pattern for that. This is a free pattern available on Ravelry, and I'm giving the oven mitts a little bit of flair by using stripes and some different colors, but mostly they're kind of muted colors. And then I'm making some felted bowls, and these will be kind of like a catch-all on a man's dresser or maybe in an entryway, a place to put keys, change, guitar picks, golf tees, that kind of thing when you come in the door. Samuel has agreed to assist with the felting. And so far, I've been designing the bowls myself. I'm kind of relying on the fact that it's an overturned hat. And, you know, you make increases, you make decreases, you bring the whole thing together at the bottom. I'm trying to give them a variety of different shapes. And also, perhaps, to add some wooden beads to them as well. So I will be photographing those felted bowls as I work on them, and I will be taking photographs, of course, of all of my work and putting it up on Ravelry and sometimes on Instagram. And maybe if I come up with a reliable design for a felted bowl that I really like, I will write up the pattern. A goal that I have for my knitting in the new year is to design some things of my own and come up with a pattern. I think it encourages me to delve into articulating what I really understand about knitting and what I still need to learn. And it becomes very apparent if I start to write down the steps I'm using to make something, whether I know what I'm doing and I understand it conceptually or I don't. And I think the felted bowls is certainly an experiment for that. I'd like them to look like pottery vessels, even though they're made out of felt. That's the challenge. I will keep you posted on my progress and the needle size I'm using, 9s and 10s. I'm using a variety of magic loop and also double pointed needles. And the pattern I mentioned is scrappy felted oven mitts for the pot holders, and that is a pattern by Kelly Schroeder. Ever expanding skill set. The Bulk Bins Cook Along is in full swing. During the month of August, we are experimenting with all variety of nuts. This week, I developed a recipe for peach almond cobbler. Peaches are in season in my local farmer's market. I think they work very well in a cobbler. And this recipe incorporates some all-purpose flour, but also whole wheat flour and almonds that have been ground into a flour. I try to keep the sugar content under control because peaches are already so lovely. And I operate off the principle my mom always instilled in us when we were growing up, that any stone fruit is made more appealing by the addition of almond extract or almonds in some form. And this recipe incorporates ground almonds in the cobbler batter and almond extract as well. I've posted it on the show notes for episode 50. I hope you give it a try and enjoy it. With the Asymmetrical, that's the Asymmetrical Craft Along, you're invited to knit, crochet, sew, weave a pattern that is asymmetrical in structure, in design, or even in use of color. Several completed projects have already been posted. There are great prizes I talked about in a previous episode, and the craft along continues until the end of September. So there's plenty of time to join in now if you'd like to. Some folks are spinning for the project. There's great conversation and camaraderie. The beautiful finished projects that have been posted are getting accolades and praise from others. Why should you want to create something that's asymmetrical in design? Well, it's interesting. It's unpredictable. The patterns can be fun to follow because it's not necessarily clear what will happen next or how the whole thing will come together. And asymmetrical design is incredibly flattering because it tends to take the viewer's eyes along a diagonal. It is slimming, it's alluring, it's dramatic, and you should give it a try with an asymmetrical garment or accessory of your choosing. Double happiness. It is so pleasing to me that folks have asked for some recommendations about poetry or mentioned that listening to my comments on poetry have made them more interested and they're exploring different poets. Kay Connors asked about a podcast that would help her become more involved in poetry and give her some things to think about and some poetry to enjoy. And I recommended a podcast called Poetry Off the Shelf. It's put out by the Poetry Foundation, which is a very highly regarded organization and has an impeccable website. I have long relied on the Poetry Foundation website as a teaching tool because the entire archive can be searched by topic, by theme, by poet, by poetic device. A lot of the poems have an audio recording of the poet or maybe some other reader reading the poem aloud. It's just an excellent resource. Poetry Off the Shelf, the podcast, attempts to tackle a particular poet or maybe a theme in poetry or a variety of poetry each episode. The host is Curtis Fox. He makes poetry accessible. I would not say that everything I hear on that podcast is poetry that I love and adore, but that in part is why I listen. So it opens my mind and I'm exposed to new things. When I listen, though, even if I don't care for the poetry, even if it's not to my taste, I always feel like I have a point of context for really understanding something about the poem. They have no use for poems that are just obscure to be obscure or over the top emotional. They're always going at it with an academic sense and a desire to understand. You can find links to the Poetry Foundation website as well as Poetry Off the Shelf on the show notes for this episode. And I'd like to conclude with a poem I just discovered this week as I was putting the episode together. I chose it because it deals with summer. I actually found it by searching summer poems on the Poetry Foundation website. It's by Howard Nemirov, a poet I respect, and it has to do with ice houses. I mentioned that at one time the creek here at Yinhu was dammed and it was a lake. I didn't mention that before refrigeration was immensely popular, ice was cut off of that lake and stored in ice houses, and on the property are still the foundations for some of those ice houses. The structures have long since disappeared. I don't think they were very solidly built, but ice would be stored in sawdust or other decomposing material for use throughout the year, and certainly it was a luxury to have ice or things that were iced in the warmer months. So I'd like to share with you a poem called Ice House in Summer by Howard Nemirov. A door sunk in a hillside with a bolt thick as the boy's arm, and behind that door the walls of ice, melting a blue, faint light, an air of cedar branches, sawdust, fern, decaying seasons, keeping from decay. A summer guest, the boy had never seen. A servant told him of it, how the lake froze 3 foot thick, how farmers came with teams, with axe and saw to cut great blocks of ice. Translucid, marbled, glittering in the sun. Load them on sleds and drag them up the hill to be manhandled down the long, narrow path and set in courses for the summer's keeping. The kitchen uses and luxuriousness of the great houses. And he heard how once a team and driver drowned in the break of spring. The man's cry melting from the ice that summer frightened the sherbet eaters off the terrace. Dust of the cedar lost and evergreen among the slowly blunting water walls, where the blade edge melted and the steel saw's bite was rounded out and the horse and rider drown in the Red Sea's blood. I was the silly child who dreamed that riderless cry and saw the guests run from a ghostly wall so long before the winter house fell with the summer house. And the houses, Egypt, the great houses, had an end.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, recorded by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving an iTunes rating or a review, or joining the show's Facebook page or Ravelry board. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire, just like Linda Kurt sings, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Nature's a will get you high till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.
This episode is dedicated to Maggie Vienna, who would like to cuddle with a cute little black bear.